marvelous. You should care for me. It's awful nice. It's paradise. It's what I love to see.
This hour of our Friday program, George Gershwin, his life and work. Howard Pollack is with us. John and Rebecca Moore is professor of music at the University of Houston. Also author of Aaron Copland, The Life and Work of an Uncommon Man, and John Alden Carpenter, a Chicago composer. The study is organized along partly, he says, thematic and partly chronological lines. He looks at Gershwin's childhood and family, musical education, his relation to popular music, his achievement as a pianist, his activities on Broadway, friendships, and love affairs. Part two, his output from his earliest compositions written at phenomenally young ages to those pieces brought forth after his death by his brother Ira. So that part of the book pays close attention to music, shows, films, recordings, and critical writings from the composer's own time and also after his death. One of the reviews said of this book, the result of all this examination is a meticulous, frank look at a gifted celebrity of the 1920s and 30s and the ways in which developing technology, from printed sheet music to pianolas to radio, affected Gershwin's life and music, and the level of detail is breathtaking. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure there are a lot of Gershwin fans out there, and we'll play some Gershwin during the course of this hour as well. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. 227-2050. Professor Howard Pollack, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Kathleen.
Nobody ever has to write another book about George Gershwin after yours, don't you think? I mean, you've done it. This is it.
It is a big book, I have to admit.
it's such a great read, too. But my gosh, the level of detail here is just amazing. Is all your work like this so meticulous and so thorough?
Well, the Copland book is a large book, too, and it's considered the definitive biography of Aaron Copland. So I'm hoping that Gershwin will have the same status.
And why did you choose him? Why is he one of the people you decided to obviously spend an incredible amount of time on him?
Well, I've always loved Gershwin's music. It's enormous fun and of great cultural interest, too. He's so seminal in the history of our culture, in the history of our musical culture. And I felt that the other books on Gershwin really didn't consider him as an artist that much. They considered him as more of a celebrity, as a man about town, you know, the tuxedoed pianist, dating Hollywood starlets and all of that. And that doesn't get us too far to understanding why this man's music, you know, 60 years after his death, is still played around the world. There has to be some deeper meaning to the music. So I was interested in exploring that.
And you write about the fact that people may have not necessarily dismissed him, but didn't give him his due because of this, you write, unlikeliness that a busy composer of musical comedies who had dropped out of high school would have either the time or the inclination to study music seriously. In fact, he did study music seriously, but the perception was that He was a party boy. He was a musical comedy guy. He was so much more than that.
Right, and the question is, why would a serious artist even devote his time to Broadway in the first place?
Right, right.
Why wouldn't he be exclusively writing for the concert hall, forgetting perhaps that in our theater history we have people like Clifford Odets and Lillian Hellman and Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, and they all worked on Broadway as well. I think there's a little bit of a prejudice against working on Broadway, but it was precisely the popularity of the Broadway stage that was the appealing thing to Gershwin. And of course, he wrote his great opera, Porgy and Bess, for the Broadway stage.
Yeah, I wasn't going to start with it, but let's talk a little bit about Porgy and Bess, because it is remarkable that this guy could capture a Negro experience the way he did and was so admired by the people who were in that play as well. It is just such a moving work that I guess people were brought to tears during auditions, weren't they?
Absolutely. And some of the most poignant testimony is from, as you say, the original black cast members who were profoundly and deeply moved by this piece in rehearsal. And interestingly, that phenomenon has happened over the years, that black artists, often approaching the work a little bit skeptically, find themselves really wrapped up in the poignance and drama of this particular piece.
How was he able to do this?
Well, that's an interesting question. He did spend a fair amount of time down in the Carolinas preparing for this work.
Mm-hmm.
He was something of a sponge. He absorbed all sorts of influences in his life, and was really remarkable in just reflecting varieties of the American experience. But there must have been certainly something about the story of these people that touched him very, very deeply.
Yeah, and he tried to break some racial barriers during that time in the Carolinas, didn't he, in terms of where he was staying? And
yes, and, when he went down with Todd Duncan to South Carolina, Todd Duncan was the black college professor that was the first Porgy, and he went down with Todd Duncan. He wanted to stay at a home with Todd Duncan, and that was forbidden by the mores of the time, which were very, very segregated. So he reluctantly stayed in another place, and Todd Duncan refers to that in a memoir, saying that Gershwin had no prejudice in him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that this, obviously he had a lot of big moments, he has a lot of incredible music, but was this a culmination of a career, Porgy and Bess? Was this the best?
Porgy and Bess is remarkable. It's hard to imagine, even knowing his entire career leading up to it. This was one of the very last things he wrote. It premiered in 1935, just 2 years before his death. One does not really expect this work. It's so monumental.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
so big. It's so long. It's so complex. One is rather staggered by it, even knowing An American in Paris and many other works leading up to it. But that's almost true of Gershwin's entire career. Rhapsody in Blue is unexpected. Everything he did was a step forward in ways that one couldn't predict from the piece he had written previously to that.
Mm-hmm. Why did he drop out of high school?
Well, he was in a vocational high school and tracked to become an accountant, and I don't think really that was what he wanted.
It's hard to imagine him becoming that.
Exactly. He had so much vitality, and I think he just needed to get out into the music world and flex his muscles and get busy right away at a career.
Mm-hmm.
He regretted not having had a more formal education, especially in liberal arts. He would have loved to have had a broader liberal arts education, but that was just something that was not in the cards for him, apparently.
Mm-hmm. But he started taking piano lessons. The family, if I can remember this right, got a piano when he was, probably about 12 years old, and he started lessons then?
About that, correct, yes. And when the family brought in the piano with the idea of giving his older brother, Ira, who was to become his principal collaborator as a lyricist for his Broadway shows, when they brought the piano in, they were amazed that Gershwin already knew how to play the piano quite well. We're not entirely sure how he acquired those skills, but there's some thought that a friend of his had a player piano at home, and he would follow along, whereas the keys moved up and down, the action of the keys, he would follow that and learn to play that way. And that's what one of the things in your introduction, you referred to the influence of technology on Gershwin's aesthetic. And there's a good example, learning the piano from a player piano.
Yeah, interesting. He also must have had, and it's hard to describe what this is, but there are some people who just sort of take to music. It's as though it's heaven sent or something. They're able to play. It just comes to them, and others have to just work away at it.
He was obviously tremendously gifted,
yes,
tremendously talented, but he worked very hard, too, and he worked extremely hard his whole life. His brother Ira commented once after his death, George always struck me as somewhat sad because he was working all the time.
Oh, that's an unusual collaboration, the two brothers. How did that come about?
Well, I think George's activities on Broadway made Ira more interested in the world of Broadway himself. He had long shown a predisposition toward verse, toward writing poetry and writing satirical pieces. So he was obviously gifted in that direction. But I think George's activities on Broadway made him more susceptible to getting involved as a Broadway lyricist. And at first, he collaborated not only with George, but with a number of other composers and had his first hits actually with Vincent Humans. Hmm. I think it was important for both of them that Ira prove his abilities independent of George so that people would not think he was just George's brother, and that's why he was writing these shows. But clearly, he was an enormously gifted lyricist in his own right. Many, many fellow lyricists and critics regard him as one of the finest, if not the finest, lyricist in the whole history of the Broadway stage. So it was extraordinary that two such talented
yes.
brothers would come out of the same family.
Isn't it, though? It's just quite something. And they lived at home for a long period of time. Why was that?
They lived at home for a long period of time. The family was extremely close, not only with their parents, but with their younger brother, Arthur, and their younger sister, Frances. And then even when they would, for instance, travel out to Hollywood to write musical films, they often lived together.
Yeah.
By that time, Ira had been was married, and so Ira and his wife and George lived together. I think they enjoyed living together because they were so focused on their collaboration that they could just start work right as early as possible. But though it used to frustrate George that Ira, who loved to stay up all night, you know, would not get up till noon, and he'd be impatiently waiting for Ira to get up so that the two of them could begin their business of work. Because when they wrote songs, they didn't write them in independent stages. I mean, they did and they didn't. There was some work that was independent. But a lot of the creativity happened with the two of them at the piano.
Yeah. So was Mama a stage mom or not?
She was a bit of a stage mom. Irving Caesar, another lyricist who George collaborated with early in his career, said that it was because of Rose's, George's and Ira's mothers pushing them to collaborate together, that they actually became a songwriting team.
Oh, that's interesting. So much of this was done, well, he didn't live very long, but so much of this was done at such a young age, wasn't it? You think people mature and get more talent and their work becomes more intricate. His work in his 20s was intricate and involved and cutting edge. It's quite remarkable.
Absolutely. He wrote The Rhapsody in Blue at age 25 years
wow.
old.
Wow.
And that got him, the following year, they got him on the cover of Time magazine, the newly established Time magazine,
huh.
at age 26.
Huh.
I mean, a composer, it's so rare for a composer to grace the cover of a major magazine to begin with, but to do that at age 26 years old is really remarkable.
It sure is. We welcome phone calls for Howard. Howard Pollack is our guest, and he's written a wonderful book about George Gershwin, and it's titled George Gershwin, His Life and Work. It looks at all aspects of this remarkable pianist and composer who did so many different kinds of compositions, and it looks at his life, his family, it looks at his musical education, and it looks at the phenomenal output of work from his earliest compositions that were, and those that were brought forward after he died. His brother Ira brought forward many other compositions. Would you like to join us? Maybe you have a favorite Gershwin song and you'd like to know about the origins of it, or you'd like to talk about his contribution to the world of musical theater or serious composition. Our number is 800-486-8655, or if you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Porgy, don't Don't let them handle me and drive me mad. If you can keep me, I wanna stay here with you forever, and I'll be so glad. Someday I know he's coming back to call on me. He's going to handle me and hold me so.
Nina Simone from Porgy and Bess. And we're talking about George Gershwin this hour of the program with the author of George Gershwin, His Life and Work. Howard Pollack is our guest. He is a professor of music at the University of Houston and has written the definitive book on the life of George Gershwin. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, please ring 414-227-2050. And we have lines open right now, 414-227-2050. We start our calls with Nancy from Madison. Hi, Nancy. Hello, Nancy. Are you there? Na-da-da. Nancy is not there. Try again. I don't know where you are, Nancy. Our number, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about the musical comedies that he was so involved with. How did he go that direction with his work? How did he enter it, Howard?
Well, when he started his career, when he started his career, he started more as a popular song composer and really got tired of the banality of pop music, what we would call top 40, which is how he kind of started his career, and was especially admiring of the music of Jerome Kern. And Jerome Kern wrote musical comedies for the Broadway stage, and he aspired to do that, to write a more sophisticated music for the Broadway stage.
The song, or and I'm not real familiar with this show, so tell me about it and how it got awarded a Pulitzer Prize, Of Thee I Sing.
Oh, yes. Well, in the late 20s, he began a collaboration with he and Ira started to collaborate with George S. Kaufman, who wrote books for musical shows, but also wrote such straight plays eventually as You Can't Take It With You and The Man Who Came to Dinner and some other great classic comedies.
Right.
And he had a very, very acerbic wit, wonderful, wonderful humor. And their first collaboration was Strike Up the Band, which actually closed out of town, but then revised, opened in 1930, and it was a very satirical. People think of the pre-war musical, the musical before Oklahoma, as being sort of pure fluff. This was a very kind of mordant satire of the sort of involvement of government and military contractors.
Oh gosh!
And such. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was a kind of one of these post-World War I disillusioned pieces about patriotism and so forth. And the title itself, Strike Up the Band, is very ironic. And then they tackle presidential politics with their second work, Of Thee I Sing, of 1931, which became the first musical comedy to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Isn't that something?
And their third collaboration was an even more mordant to the point that it was not particularly successful on Broadway because it was such a dark work, and that's Let Him Eat Cake, which was written in 1933, and it's kind of a fantasy about a totalitarian America. So you could get a sense from just those little plot descriptions that sometimes there were more to these musical comedies than some people might assume.
Right, and maybe it's time for a revival of some of them, unless there's already been one.
Well, Of Thee I Sing gets revived pretty regularly. I saw one at the Maplewood Theater in New Jersey a couple of years ago. And it had, Of Thee I Sing also had a very, very successful staging at Encores, which is New York's premier showcase for reviving older theater. And many critics said that Of Thee I Sing kind of salvaged a lackluster season. So Of Thee I Sing gets revived pretty regularly.
Let's go to Marty from Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you. I'm wondering if your guest can tell me if this story is true or not. I had heard some years ago that after George's death, Ira was understandably quite depressed and really deeply grieving, and finally dragged himself into the studio, and that the first lyrics he wrote were for music that George had written, and the song was Our Love Is Here to Stay, which, if that's true, it just, every time I hear that song, it has a whole new kind of little bittersweet spin on it.
God, I love that song. I just love that song.
It is one of the very last songs that George wrote, and it was written for the film that they were working on at the time of his death. And many people do kind of read that into the lyric that Ira was thinking of George. In fact, the chorus itself was written before George's death, so that sort of undercuts that the possibility of that. They had auditioned the song for Sam Goldwyn, who was the producer of this film, in the weeks before his death. So the lyric, at least the chorus with the refrain, Love Is Here to Stay, Our Love Is Here to Stay, was actually written before George's death.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call.
Thanks for the question.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me how so much of this music has lasted for such a long period of time. And that song could have been... the words are so lovely and written with such great care, but that song is just something that's been a part of my life always. It just goes on and on and on, right?
I think these very final songs, I think Gershwin reached new heights in the realm of the popular song, in the realm of the Broadway musical and the Hollywood film score in the years just before his death. I mean, he was writing works also like songs like Foggy Day and so forth, a little bit before that, Embraceable You. I mean, really classic, great songs. And, of course, it's a huge, his early death is a huge loss because we have no idea where he would have taken the popular song. But even at that early age, in his mid-30s, he was bringing it to tremendous heights.
Yes. Jane from Stevens Point, hi.
Hi, Kathy. Wonderful program.
Thanks, Jane.
I am wondering about any relationship or comparison between George Gershwin and Cole Porter, who happens to be my favorite composer and lyricist.
Well, Gershwin was both the Gershwins were huge admirers of Cole Porter. I think he was one of the very few that they set up on as a pinnacle of songwriting. And Gershwin and Porter were friendly when they were in Paris in 1928 with Gershwin's sister. She was featured in a review of Porter's songs. There was a lot of close ties between them. When he came back to New York in the 30s, they socialized a fair amount. Gershwin even wanted to collaborate with Cole Porter, which is very rare. By that point, he'd been working so long with Ira, it's unusual that he would want to collaborate with another lyricist, but apparently he admired Cole Porter as a lyricist so much, not only as a composer, but as a lyricist, because Cole Porter did write his own words, that he would have liked to have written a song with Cole Porter. But unfortunately, we don't have a Gershwin-Porter collaboration. Mm. It would have been nice.
Oh, yeah, I sure would have. Anything else, Jane?
I was just going to say, I hope that your guest chooses Cole Porter for his next book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Jane. We go to Elliot from Milwaukee next. Hi, Elliot.
Yes, to go back to Of Thee I Sing for a moment, it was performed here in Milwaukee at the Sunset Theater, and I had a role in it. And I had never heard it before. I'd been very interested in Gershwin for many years. But I was wondering, the satire of that was not really from Gershwin. That was from Kaufman, is that correct?
Right.
I was told it was based on the Miss America pageant. And why was the vice president so relegated and the South so dissed in that production?
Well, you know, that's today in the day of Dick Cheney, portrayal of the vice president is a total non-entity who can hardly get into the White House is a little remote from us. But in the 20s and 30s, the vice president was really a very marginalized figure. So that's the reason for that satire. They had fun satirizing the South, but of course they had fun satirizing everything, didn't they? And so that's just part of Kaufman's satiric genius was to satirize different aspects of the American experience.
What Gershwin was doing was just the songs. He wasn't really involved in the writing of the book.
Well, the idea of the book was initially was Kaufman and his co-writer Morse Hart. Maury Riskin. Maury Riskin co-wrote the book with him. But even from the early stages, they collaborated with the Gershwins. They would send them scenarios and ask them, what do you think of this and what do you think of that? But clearly Kaufman was leading the way for that particular satire. But he found a very, very congenial spirit in Gershwin and Iron Judge Gershwin. That said, Kaufman was very famous for not being able to introduce the sentimental romantic note in his satires, and which is one of the reasons he worked with collaborators like Maury Riskin. And there are moments in the show, as you well know, as having been in the show, where the music brings a certain amount of sentiment, and as in the slow when they sing "Who Cares" slowly in the show. And there's an anecdote about Kaufman and being with George Gershwin during the show, and he's noticing that the audience is getting sort of, despite the fact that they're satirizing it, they're sort of kind of taken up with the romantic drama of the president and the first lady. And Kaufman said to Gershwin, "Don't they know we're kidding, love? Why are they taking this so seriously?" And he's, and George said, "You might think that we're kidding, love, but this audience is taking this love story seriously." So that blend of the dynamic between Gershwin's romanticism and Kaufman's wit, I think, was a very, very interesting.
Oh, very
one.
Interesting. Yeah. Was it fun to be in the show, Elliot?
Oh, it was hysterical. It was almost like a Marx Brothers movie.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was mocked.
Huh.
But it was done subtly, you know, so I think the audience did kind of fall for some of the stuff, like this fabulous author who's done such a meticulous job as describing. It's fascinating to hear all the details. It's hard to get that information about Gershwin in particular.
Oh, you can get it now with this book, let me tell you.
Sounds like it.
Yeah.
So thank you very much
all
for
right.
a wonderful program.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thanks for the question. And I'd like to also just add about Kaufman is that he did write those initial vehicles that brought the Marx Brothers their initial fame, Animal Crackers and some other things. So when we see the Marx Brothers, we are getting, everyone thinks the humor originated completely with the Marx Brothers, but much of their material was written by Kaufman, and he kind of shaped their persona. So that gives you an idea of what sort of humor he had.
Right. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. Was George Gershwin involved in political life at all, Howard?
Hard to say. Certainly Ira was. Ira became very associated with lots of liberal causes over the years. George was involved enough in his own time that he kind of provoked the scorn of Senator McCarthy during the McCarthy years. This is a good, 15 years after his death. But there was some talk about banning his music from State Department libraries.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so there was, and he did support when the Mexican artist Securus came to the United States and was involved in his posters, May Day posters and so forth. He helped support Securus. Though his own politics, I think, could be described probably as liberal democratic politics.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with the author of Gershwin, George Gershwin, His Life and Work. Howard Pollack is our guest. He is a professor of music at the University of Houston and has written several other books. Aaron Copland, The Life and Work of an Uncommon Man, and George Alden Carpenter, a Chicago composer. Welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. That's 800-486-8655.
My sweet, embraceable you. Embrace me, you irreplaceable you. Just one look at you.
Sarah Vaughan with George Gershwin's Embraceable You. George Gershwin, His Life and Work this hour. Welcoming calls for Howard at 800-486-8655 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Rhapsody in Blue, and our guest is the author of George Gershwin, His Life and Work, Howard Pollack. And we're welcoming phone calls at 800-486-8655. Gordon is our next caller, Howard from St. Cloud. Hi, Howard. I mean, hi, Gordon.
Good morning to you.
Hello.
And you were just playing the most favorite song in the whole world.
Oh, I'm glad we played it for you, Gordon.
Now, there's a story I heard, God, a long time ago, that when Gershwin first played that song at in a music hall someplace in New York, it was a very hot, steamy day, and the newspaper people were starting to get out of their seats and move out until they heard that song, and they all returned.
Huh.
Is there any truth to that?
Howard?
I think Gordon is referring to the premiere of Rhapsody in Blue.
Hmm.
And it was, first of all, it was in February on a snowy day. So that part of the story is wrong, Gordon.
I guess, yeah.
As far as the restlessness of the people, it was programmed at the very end of a long concert.
Hmm.
And legend has it that people were getting restless in the course of the show, in the course of the musical, and then the concert, and then Gershwin came out and played Rhapsody in Blue, and people just ran back, you know, started to leave for the exits, and they all ran back to their seats. And that was actually dramatized as such in the biopic Rhapsody in Blue, starring Robert Alder, the 1945 film biography of Gershwin. And it's actually been reported that way in some of the books. My reading and my research suggests, on the contrary, that people were enjoying the concert enormously from beginning to end.
Hmm.
It was a great novelty for this audience of comprised of Broadway stars and vaudevillians and classical music musicians, including Serge Rachmaninoff.
Oh my gosh!
People, and
oh my.
Yasha Heifetz and Galakirchy and all these celebrated classical artists who had come more to hear Paul Whiteman than to hear George Gershwin. He wasn't really that well known. And we're just enchanted by the concert from beginning to end. So I'm afraid that there's a lot of legend there.
Oh, shucks. I like the story the way I heard it.
I'll keep telling it. It's all right. You can just, you know, tell your own version of it.
How do you classify that song? Is it classical music? Is it jazz?
Yeah, good question. What is it?
Well, you know,
Gershwin.
Gershwin makes those labels difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's. At the time, people would have called it symphonic jazz. But today, I think most people would refer to it as probably a piece of classical music.
Mm-hmm.
They call it. It is, to me, the most beautiful song ever written.
Mm.
It's probably the most popular concert work written in the 20th century.
Is it really?
I think it might be, yeah.
Thanks, Gordon. I'm sure you're going to listen to it today. Thank you. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thanks for your call. Nancy from Madison. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I'm sorry I got cut off before, but my question about musical theater, Broadway musical theater, is what if you would talk about some of the songs that got pulled out of not very popular musicals, musicals that actually failed, and now those songs have become some of the jazz standards that we hear today.
And the question is, I'm sorry, Nancy?
Oh, that could you refer to some of the songs from failed musicals that were so too good to lose and they got pulled out and became jazz standards today?
Yes, that's a good question. There are many songs like that. And the most famous one, certainly, and one of Gershwin's greatest song is The Man I Love.
Mm-hmm.
Which he wrote in 1924 for Adele Astaire to sing with her brother Fred Astaire in the 1924 musical comedy Lady Be Good. The song didn't quite work on stage. The show was a little bit long in tryouts, and they decided to cut the song. But they knew they had a great song on their hands. And the problem in terms of getting the song popular without it having a place on the show in a show was sometimes a problem. So sometimes they successfully could recycle a song in another show. An example of that would have been I've Got a Crush on You, which was written for a Gertrude Lauren show, Treasure Girl, which was one of their few flops, and they recycled that as in the revised version of Strike Up the Band, and it became popular as a result of that. But Lady Be Good, they tried and tried to find a show. It was slotted at one point for a show they wrote for Flo Ziegfeld, Rosalie, and other shows they tried to work it into, and they just didn't have a success doing it. But somehow that song, because there were a couple of recordings of the song, including one by Helen Morgan, that song managed to have a life of its own. And as Nancy was saying, it's perhaps one of the great jazz standards of all time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nancy. Let's go to Lou from Kenosha next. Hi, Lou.
Hi, Kathleen. I was listening to Howard before, and I had just walked in the door when he started talking. My prized possession of all my old antique phonographs and a number of things is the original recording made in 1927 with George Gershwin playing and Whiteman conducting the orchestra. It's just absolute favorite, and I get chills every time I play it. The version that you played on the radio is the closest one that they can come to.
Yeah, Leonard Bernstein is playing, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm just so pleased to have it because I've loved that song for all my life.
Yes. How do you preserve it?
It's sitting on a phonograph downstairs. I play it for guests. It has its own special needle, so I crank up the Victrola and play it for my guests.
Huh.
It's always a hit. It's always a hit.
I have to agree with your caller that though Rhapsody in Blue has been recorded dozens and dozens of times by many of the greatest pianists of the 20th century, it's really testimony to Gershwin's ability as a pianist that his two recordings of Rhapsody in Blue stand up as among the very, very best. Hmm. And just for your callers, edification, the 1927 is actually the second of two recordings that Gershwin did with Paul Whiteman. The first was in 1924, and the second was in 1927. And in fact, Gershwin and Paul Whiteman, by that point, over that three-year period, had really had various disagreements about playing the work, about how it was to be performed, and they had something of a spat in the recording studio. And it's not Whiteman, apparently, who's actually conducting the piece. I think it's Nathaniel Shilkret, if I'm not mistaken, who's conducting, who took over the baton. But you could read the details about that in my book.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Lou, for the call. We go next to Mike from West Bend. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I have a question first for the guest. Which of the New York boroughs did Gershwin grow up in with his family?
He was born in Brooklyn, but he grew up primarily in Manhattan.
Okay. My anecdote is I used to live down in Miami, and I used to go frog hunting in the Everglades with a friend of mine. And deep in the Everglades, I met this hermit who was sort of a recluse kind of a guy who escaped from society. I had an interesting conversation with him because he had grown up in New York and lived in the apartment building where the Gershwins, and told me that he knew the whole family. And he said, for one thing, that even though everybody in the family was expected to do odd jobs and chores and everything to help finance things, George was always the favorite, but he didn't have to do anything but practice, and he did practice 12 or 14 hours a day at no one's urging.
Is that story true, Howard? I don't know. Not the hermit part of the story, but the other part.
It sounds plausible.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So the family really was supporting him and his talent.
I think so. To a certain extent. I mean, it depends what age we're talking about. In the earlier years, I mean, his mother was, I think, reasonably concerned that having her two oldest sons go into show business was not the most practical decision
right.
in the world, and she was concerned about their ability to make a living and so forth. But on the other hand, they seemed to be they loved the theater, they loved music, so they were supportive in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike, for the call. He died at such a young age of a brain tumor. Did he experience any symptoms of sickness toward the end of his life or not?
He did. He started to have blackouts, and he started to have some olfactory hallucinations, which means he smelled things, smelled burning rubber, and other symptoms that actually, you know, point to the possibility, if not the likelihood, of a brain tumor. But it went undiagnosed, and the symptoms started to get more serious in the last few weeks of his life. He began to stumble. He spilled glasses of water. He couldn't manage to eat. He had blinding headaches that threw him to the ground in pain. And with all that, friends, family, and the medical community maintained that he was suffering from stress and psychological problems.
Oh my.
It's really extraordinary. And there's a fairly large medical literature about Gershwin's death and final illness. And doctors themselves have taken the medical community to task about that.
Mm-hmm. Greg from Oconomowoc. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen. I'd like to know if I read some time ago that George Gershwin wanted to study with Maurice Ravel, but Ravel wouldn't have it. What is there to that story? And the second question is Rhapsody in Blue again. I read or heard that we hear the second ending to that piece, that there was a different original ending. Please illuminate that for me. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
I'm not sure about the second ending to Rhapsody in Blue. I mean, there were some changes that were made over the years, but nothing that would have affected the ending. There's an interesting story about the opening. That very famous clarinet glissando that begins the piece was actually not Gershwin's idea. He had written a scale for the a more conventional scale for the clarinet. And the clarinetist in the Paul Whiteman band, who was an extraordinary clarinetist, Russ Gorman, in rehearsal took it as a glissando, and he said, "Is this okay to do it this way?" And Gershwin said yes. And, of course, it's one of the most memorable things about Rhapsody in Blue is that very opening glissando, that sliding sound as the clarinet goes from its lowest register to its top register. And it's very, very difficult, incidentally, to do that, for a clarinetist to play a glissando like that without breaking in the middle. As for the caller's first question, that's absolutely true. Gershwin admired Ravel. He met him in 1928. He was Ravel had asked Gershwin to play at his 50th birthday party, which was in New York. And on that occasion, Gershwin asked if he could study with Ravel, and Ravel rarely took on private students, and said on that occasion, I really don't want to take you to you on as a student because you have such great originality and gifts as a composer. I'd be concerned that you would wind up writing second-rate Ravel rather than first-rate Gershwin. But in fact, he did write a letter the following day to Nadia Boulanger in Paris, one of the great composition teachers of the 20th century, asking if she would be interested or willing to take Gershwin on as a student. Gershwin, when he went to Paris later that year, knocked at her door. She also turned him down for the same reasons, that he was doing so well at that point. He didn't need he didn't need any more composition lessons. Though, in fact, in the 1930s, Gershwin continued to study composition with Joseph Schillinger and others. So he continued to study music his whole life.
Mm-hmm. And what about what people thought of him? We talked at the beginning of the hour about the fact that he had dropped out of high school and some people thought he was not serious. He was a musical comedy guy. You've talked about famous composers, though, who heard Rhapsody in Blue, who were in the audience. Did he, during the course of his lifetime, become widely admired by serious musicians as well?
He was very widely admired, I would say especially by European musicians, more so than American musicians, because obviously, for the obvious reasons, that Americans felt maybe a little bit sensitive about Gershwin's great fame at their expense. So there was rivalry, more rivalry. I think Americans felt more sense of rivalry. The Europeans didn't have that sense of rivalry. They looked at Gershwin and said, "Oh, this is just a great American composer, great American talent." And though the admiration was not universal, some of the people that gave him the highest praise included William Walton, Dmitri Shostakovich. Francis Poulenc called An American in Paris one of his favorite works of the century.
Oh, my.
An enormous number of admirers. Arnold Schoenberg became a great admirer. Bela Bartok dedicated one of his pieces to, or not dedicated, but wrote one of his last pieces in the, quote, in the style of George Gershwin. So that gives you an idea of how Europeans, at any rate, responded to Gershwin.
How about you? How do you rank him?
I think he's very high in the pantheon of American musicians, one of the most original and enduring composers that we've produced, and that reputation is not tarnished over the years. If anything, it seems brighter than ever, as I hear so many young composers who are beginning to, or not beginning, but after a period of academic trends, writing music somewhat in the lines of along the lines of Gershwin. To a certain extent, we see how he was really prescient in terms of what American music is evolving in the 21st century.
Howard, thank you so much for the book and the conversation today. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's been great.
Howard Pollack, he's the author, and the book is George Gershwin, His Life and Work. It is the definitive word on George Gershwin. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks also to Rhonda for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. Copies of the show, call the radio store at 800-747-7444. The program number is 46E. The show will repeat tonight if you want to hear it again or tell somebody about it at 10 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I'll be kind of chilling next week, so I won't be here. So I'll be with you in about a week. Have a good weekend.